are tuned into Lightly on the Ground Radio, produced at Richmond Independent Radio and broadcast on WRIR LP 97.3 and worldwide at WRIR.org. We're exploring our food system, which includes everything from farm to table. It extends from a seed in a farmer's hand to a bill in the hands of those making policy on the local, national, and worldwide fronts. We focus on growing and sustaining our food system. And while we're talking local, the ideas are pertinent to any food system. Christopher Doval is here in the outdoor studio at Epic Gardens. A few years ago, he took a position as an assistant professor at the VSU, that's Virginia State University, Reginald L. Lewis School of Business. And what are you teaching there, Christopher?
Well, for the most part, I teach the intro business law courses and ethics and corporate sustainability.
Ethics and corporate sustainability. Well, that kind of leads us right into where we're going here.
Right.
That's a good catch. So you've come here today to talk about genetic engineering. And I met you at a panel discussion recently with a lot of people who were talking about the different aspects of genetic engineering. And I found that it was difficult to pull out the facts and the science and the legal aspects of it from a good deal of excitement about it. It's a very exciting topic now. Everybody knows GMO, even though they may not be able to say exactly what it means. But what I was interested in getting to here is the fact that there are very likely useful uses for genetic engineering.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Could you begin by describing classical breeding and genetic engineering and where they're separate?
So, okay, in terms of classical, I'll use selection. Like, think Charles Darwin, Origin of Species, very simple, how we decide to breed things together and change the original composition to something that we like. So, if you want to talk plants, let's say that you grow apples and you find that you have a certain set of apple that has a brilliant red color to it, and you would like to just have that color in the rest of your apples. Well, you would cross-pollinate between the two apples and hope that that trait goes into the offspring.
And it takes years and years and years with apples to see whether or not that happens.
Yeah, there's you have to grow the tree.
Yeah. Right.
But there's a lot of trial and error involved. It's very sloppy.
Right. And I think that's why they were working with something with a shorter life, like peas. Isn't that where... Llewellyn? Who was the pea breeder?
Oh, God.
Uh-oh, our elementary school history is evading us.
Oh, no. I lost that all a long time ago.
Okay. There was someone breeding peas because they had a shorter span and they would actually be able to see the differences in maybe three or four generations.
Absolutely. And this is the same sort of thing between horses and donkeys, trying to get mules. The idea is you want, when you breed the two, you're trying to get the certain qualities from both breeds into the new one. Again, sloppy and a lot of other traits that you may not have wanted may carry over as well. Same thing with the apple situation.
So that's basic classical breeding, where
Right.
you actually are pollinating and cross-pollinating and that sort of thing.
Correct.
Okay, so when you get into genetic engineering, you're taking the genes from one creature and installing them neatly into an appropriate place in another creature's DNA.
Correct.
Okay, so how does that work? How do you decide? Well, how are the scientists choosing what traits to move from one to the other?
Well, a lot of them is based on what your goal is. So we had mentioned the golden rice idea. The whole golden rice idea is that there's about 500,000 children that go blind due to vitamin A deficiency. Well, if we can find a way to get vitamin A into their diets, this would certainly improve their quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is to take beta carotene that is found in carrots and try to find a way to implant the gene that exhibits the trait for beta carotene development and place that into rice. So a lot of the reasons we do the genetic engineering is for what kind of goals do we want. Currently we don't have any animals that are genetically modified that are for eating for consumption. But we're certainly trying to make salmon that grow faster, because we found that there's trace between other fish that make salmon grow faster.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into some specifics. How about, I mean, there's a lot of consternation around it and the effects that it might have in the long run. What are some examples of safe, effective applications of genetic modification that are already in the system?
Okay, so there's a long list, and mm-hmm. they differ from animals to plants.
Let's just stick with plants then.
Okay, so in terms of plants, we see, we can talk about crops and we can talk about just how we manipulate plants. Because there's the ones we eat and there's the ones we don't. So in terms of the ones that we eat, all independent research institutions have looked at the safety of GMO crops, have shown that they are safe to eat. We're including the European Union, who has far stricter rules.
And they only allow a few GM crops in their entire agrosystem.
Right.
And we have dozens, I believe. I forget the exact number.
Oh, absolutely. Well,
but yes, they are very cautious.
They're very cautious. And that's part of their culture, is they're very cautious about this sort of thing. Beyond that, we have our FDA, we have our EPA, our USDA that govern our, or at least protect our interests regarding it, and they believe it's safe as well. So that's in terms of just whether or not it's safe for us to eat. Now, when we're talking about plants, we can manipulate them like in golden rice for the sake of nutrition. The idea of helping a deficiency in someone's diet. We can talk about greater yields. It's pretty safe. In India, I believe maybe it's the rice or the wheat, has been able to, their yields have doubled and their profits have improved a great deal. I'm sorry. Their profits have gotten increased by 50% and their yields by 24%. Just by manipulating how they breed their crops.
Okay, are you talking about agribusiness, U.S. agribusiness companies going into India and selling them systems that involve weed suppressants, seeds that don't reproduce as seeds that they can't save because they're hybrids or because they're GMO?
Oh, no, I'm just saying that we have genetically modified crops that yield more. They yield more crop that can be sold. So in terms of that sense, that's something. Suicide seeds, and those are sold as well. But I consider that to be more, that's a way in terms of intellectual property, being able to protect your interests on the company side. It's, I don't know where the ethics are involved and how people feel about that differently. But as an attorney in the intellectual property side, it's very important that when you spend a lot of money on research and development, that you be able to protect what you create. And this is a huge issue in the whole GM world.
Well, tell us more about that, because that is one of the issues that is in the forefront of concerns among American citizens and the food system.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what we're dealing right now is with the patents. And with patents, you create an invention that has a variety of criteria to satisfy being an invention, and genetically modified seeds have fallen underneath that sort of protection. So you reveal how you make these sort of things to the public, and the federal government will give you a protection, a control of the use of that invention for 20 years. And you'll be able to sell, say how it's distributed, but this leads to a lot of problems for the sake that when you're dealing with seeds and plants, it is so difficult to maintain control over their breeding, their dispersal, or their cross-pollinating.
Let's turn that IP idea around a little bit, because we all have our own intellectual property, and there are farmers out mm-hmm. here who are carefully breeding their own varieties that are specific to their territory.
Correct.
And that will do beautifully in their environment. They know which funguses and viruses are going to cruise through when. They're breeding for, they'll take the tomatoes off the plants that don't seem to be susceptible and then just narrow down that little gene pool
right.
a little bit. And so people are doing that as their own personal mm-hmm. effort at creating their own intellectual property, which might go on. I have a friend up in Hanover County, Kevin Damian, bred the Damian's Hanover Gold tomato. It's a small, sweet tomato that is comparable to the hybrids that are very popular. It doesn't crack as much as the hybrid variety that's very popular. And he actually is marketing it now. He went that 7 years to stabilize the seed, and now you can get it through Southern Exposure Seed Exchange. You can get it through his place.
Wow.
So he has actually bred a tomato. So,
when it comes to this idea of who's in the wrong, I think that due to the public nature, the importance to the public of seeds and our food supply, there's good argument that perhaps there should be patent reform, and I would advocate for that. The sake that, there's a lot of discomfort in the community about people owning the rights to all the food, and I think that makes sense. Like, I would be concerned about that too, as far as it goes for water rights and such as well. So, when it comes to patents, yes, it's an issue for the sake that crops will breed with neighboring crops and contaminate them in such a way that now they are constitute intellectual property of a company.
Spin that out.
So now let's say we have one farmer who's decided to invest in a biotech company's seeds. Well, he can't help but be in an area surrounded by other farmers and who share the same bees, who share the same wind. And so his genetically modified plants will, essentially their pollen will just travel within a reasonable amount of area, often very, very long. For as long as a bee can travel, I suppose. And when they cross-pollinate, we see kind of what we're doing with the natural breeding, is where the genetic information from the genetically modified crops will commingle with those of the organic or not genetically modified crops. In a horrible situation for the farmer who's not initially invested in those crops, we have now an intellectual property concern where they don't have the licensing rights to own or use that intellectual property. Now, this sounds really unintuitive to people, but when you create something, you have the patent, you license it out. So you give people the opportunity to use it. And in terms of owning the rights to seeds, it's now the case that someone who has not been allowed to, has not been given a license, a use for those seeds, has it. And under patent law, we have the opportunity to litigate and destroy crops if they tend to exhibit these qualities of genetically modified crops that they did not license.
Well, let me ask this question about that. If someone's genetic trespass,
that's a very good way to put it,
goes, infringes on someone else's, say, organic or just classically bred crop, whose fault is it?
So, well, there's a lot to be said about the licensing agreement itself.
Right, the licensing agreement, the plant variety protection. Mm-hmm. It seems kind of like a corporation has more rights to a crop or more rights to a livelihood than do individuals who are growing food.
Now, I will put a bit of responsibility on the farmer who decided to invest in genetically modified crops. The choice that he made, perhaps he's dealing with drought or he's dealing with a variety of other problems that the seed can fix, but there's a responsibility to be able to handle or contain the license. I have a great deal of a moral issue behind the idea of going and destroying neighboring crops because they've been contaminated with someone's seed. But this is where we go, and I think it's very obvious that we might need to change how patent laws work regarding how well, plants particularly. So right now we're kind of in a bad place, particularly for the small farmer. I would rather the discussion be about food education. Once we get everybody on board and they have understanding and then a decision based off of what they understand, then we could talk about labeling. But as I said, if your people are unaware, I think they're just going to tend towards one direction in purchasing their food and essentially just warp the market in a direction that does not, that may not be appropriate or not what they initially intended. So I'm more interested in food education before we go into the direction of labeling. But then again, I would like to know what's in my food.
So how would you go about educating people on what is in their food without actually labeling it as such?
Well, this is a response that I would think certainly at the like elementary school level. This is a very interesting conversation for kids to grow up with. I think a lot of us, at least myself, I got brainwashed to recycle because it was on television all the time.
Right.
And so this is a discussion, and I think the ethics alone are fascinating to talk about. What's important to you? Mm-hmm. And so labeling is fantastic. If people want it, they can go ahead. I want people to be more educated about the decision beforehand. So where I have my values and the way I look at the world, and I'm pro genetically modified organisms, if it doesn't work for you, that's fine. But I need you to know why you feel that way, mm-hmm. as opposed to being told by the internet or someone on the news. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm more interested in food education.
Okay. Well, you are listening to Lightly on the Ground Radio, produced at Epic Gardens. The sound effects are live and in person, as is Chris Stovall. Chris, you picked out a tune for us to play. Why don't you tell us what it is, and just a tiny bit about it.
This is one of my favorite groups that's come out of these. It's an Australian group, Cut Copy. Cut Copy Paste.
Uh-huh.
It's a track, Going Nowhere.
And what's it about?
You know what? It's actually just kind of what I think to be fun, light indie music.
All right. And there's nothing like fun, light indie music. And you get a lot of indie music on WRIR, don't you?
Yeah.
The Richmond Independent Radio. All right. Well, let's listen for a minute. School of Business, and there's a School of Agriculture there too. Do you have any cross-pollination with them?
That is certainly one of our goals.
Uh-huh.
Every university has this tendency to create silos where they live in their own building and they don't associate. But sustainability being such a strong issue, particularly in business, it's a very natural direction.
It has tentacles everywhere.
It does.
Yeah.
And it keeps me wearing a lot of hats.
What do you perceive as a way of cooperating with the School of Agriculture, particularly because their mission, as I remember, is to create profitable small family farms?
Correct.
And
it's one of the many things they do.
Right. Yeah, but I wish I had their mission statement in front of me, but that was a recent thing with the new dean, Jewel Hairston. They came together over this. Well, they've always had a small farm, a powerful small farm family outreach project over there. And actually, when you mentioned the silos, something came to mind. One of the breeders there was breeding edamame, mm-hmm. and we had harvested a bunch of edamame, and we're trying to figure out how to get it to market. So we had extension agents and professors from the School of Agriculture and a couple of students and myself and just a room full of people who normally would not have had the opportunity to hang out together. Mm-hmm. And we enjoyed it so much. And after sitting around, you know, just plucking edamame off the vines for a few hours, we realized, I remember Chris Mullins particularly said that he had never heard a conversation quite like what we were having there, because mm-hmm. the School of Agriculture, the research end, and extension were there together in the same room with nothing to do but talk. So it is a rare thing. We do create these silos.
Now, in terms of the School of Agriculture and how the school business can interact, one, my demographic of student is typically a city dweller. I myself am from the city of Richmond, and I come here, and this is gorgeous, but it's very alien to some of my students to be involved with that side. They think business, and they think record labels. They think cars. They think iPads. They don't necessarily think of food as a major market. And I think there's a lot to be said about interacting with something just so simple like where you get your food that gives you a little bit more exposure and humility. Another thing is trying to find opportunities for students to practice what they've learned. And so service learning is something that we completely believe in at VSU in terms of getting people working with businesses. And so in my sustainability course, their final exam is to, or their project is to work with a small business in Petersburg and help them in whatever way they can in terms of sustainability. We have worked with several very micro small farmers. A man who was selling goldfish, who he collected rain in rain barrels, and he had an issue with mosquitoes in his rain barrels. So he started growing goldfish in his rain barrels and selling those to local stores. Mm-hmm. You know, micro business in a very creative way.
If, when you go to the Small Family Farm Outreach Conference and things like that, you'll see hundreds of farmers from, you know, they'll come 150 miles to go to a program down at Randolph Farm. And they'll set up tents and have demonstration plots of different crops. And there's one man, Cliff Slade, who used to be a row cropper. And he was pretty invested in row crops as well as specialty vegetables, of course. But he realized after growing food that on a few acres, he can make more money growing organically produced vegetables than he can growing hundreds of acres of row crops.
Based off like the markup he can have for organic foods, like the people.
Just the cost of growing real food versus food for animals.
Oh, okay.
And versus food for seed. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of growing a triple crop of corn, wheat, and soybeans, mm-hmm. you just grow a few acres and intensely growing vegetables. He showed an acre. How many square feet are in an acre? 43,500.
I became an attorney, so I didn't have to do math.
Okay. Well, he made a dollar a square foot on an acre growing vegetables, and it was $43,000 plus.
This is part of the complicated reform that we need to take into consideration. Mm-hmm. Because I see we're trying to protect ourselves from the larger companies, the few that exist that have a great deal of intellectual property that they've collected through acquiring companies, acquiring seed. But part of this is, aside from protecting us from what a lot of people think is scary companies, is that we need to make sure that we can protect the interests of people who have spent 7 years of their life working towards a goal. Those are the interests we're going to have to balance.
Well, Christopher, it sounds like we really don't have any answers.
No.
But that's why we're here.
That's why we're here. But this is the opportunity for us to discuss and figure out who's on which side and which is best for all of us. And so, not until we come together and make these decisions
together, talk to our representatives, can we come up with what's in the best interest? For instance, the issue regarding the small farmer, I have not dealt with that issue. Mm-hmm. And I would say a lot of people aren't aware of that.
Well, I'm glad you're aware of it now, yeah. Because it's happening all over the country, because right. We are all working on individual levels to preserve our genetic diversity and to replenish things. Like, people find seeds in old jars and throw them out and find out they have something amazing.
But I think this is part of the issue, that the consumer, the average consumer, is not concerned about these issues. And I myself, being so cold with my view on biodiversity, maybe if I was given a little bit more information, or maybe a little more in touch.
The education that you're talking about from the very beginning.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of responsibility regarding this, educating the consumer, exerting what's important. And it goes beyond food. It goes to water. It goes to energy consumption. Driving to work. And this is, as we said, the tentacles of sustainability.
Mm-hmm. The tentacles of sustainability. I think that's what we'll title this show.
I think I'm going to use that from now on in my class.
Okay. And we thought of it here. Well, this is Lightly on the Ground Radio, and we've recorded it here at Ethic Gardens. And our guest today was Christopher Neal Duval, Esquire. And he is a professor at Virginia State University in the School of Business. Our theme music was Bonefire Dance by Rattlemouth, and we hope that you will join us again in a very little while, and that you will keep in touch with us by visiting us on Facebook. Lightly on the Ground Radio has a Facebook page where you will find out who's going to be on the show and when podcasts become available. So, Christopher, any last words?
I wasn't prepared for any, but it was a wonderful time, and I'm very jealous of your place here at Ethic Gardens.
Well, thank you. It's a work in progress.